Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, September 3rd, 2013, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Well, we're pleased to have paranormal investigator and author Nick Redfern back with us tonight. Originally from England and now living in the Dallas area, Nick has written 27 books on numerous paranormal subjects, as well as articles in well-known publications. He's made over 70 TV appearances on major shows like Ancient Aliens, UFO Hunters, Fox News, the BBC, and National Geographic, to mention just a few. And he's here to share more of his fascinating stories on a variety of paranormal subjects. He's a diligent researcher and an articulate speaker, very knowledgeable on so many paranormal subjects, so we know you'll enjoy the show. His books can be found on warwickassociates.com. That's W-A-R-W-I-C-K associates.com. And his website is nickredfern.com. That's N-I-C-K-R-E-D-F-E-R-N.com. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News segment with Anastasia bringing topics of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails from our listeners. Well, we've gathered almost all of the Next Crystal Soul group to go with us to Arkansas to dig for Atlantean crystals, experience crystal activations, and reconnect with Soul Family. There is one spot still available, so if you feel drawn, send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com. All you need to qualify is to have 25, 26, or 27 degrees of Taurus, Scorpio, Aquarius, Leo, Capricorn, or Cancer on your natal or progress chart. That means you have the rites of passage to participate. The date is October 8th through the 14th. We'd like to thank Chris for hosting our switchboard this evening, and you're welcome to call in with comments or questions. The number to dial is 917-889-8292. Remember to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. If you like our show, we'd appreciate your support by clicking follow on our show page. And if you're joining us for the first time, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where you can find a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge, and the entire site has been coded for Starseed activation. We have a forum for Starseeds at starseedhotline.ning.com, and we'd like to thank Rose and Tammy for their great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can also find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go, or download them right from our show page archives. Now, before we get started, I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. And please allow about 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you get it in time. And if you'd like a Stage 2 reading to interpret those energies, make sure you book it about 2 months before your birthday, because we do have a waiting list. So now I'd like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Good evening, ladies. How are you doing?
Good evening, Arielle, Lavendar.
I'm really anxious to hear what you have to tell us about the sun. Do we have any sunspots that are fixing to erupt?
There's none actively flaring at the moment, but they say that there's a couple of sunspots that have beta-gamma magnetic fields that pose a threat for M-class solar flares, and they say one of those, AR-1836, is directly facing the Earth right now. What's been going on with the sun is not much, but we have been getting a lot of auroras in the northern latitudes, so it's a great time to watch the northern lights. They've been very active this year. So that's what's going on with the sun. And I want to say good evening to all you Starseed listeners. It's great to be back with you tonight. And I want to let you guys know that I experienced something that blew my mind last week, just a few days ago, actually. It was the 28th of August, and it was recorded and reported all over the southeastern United States. It was a major fireball event, and NASA's Meteoroid Environmental Office has upgraded the latest estimates of this major fireball that exploded over the southeastern United States about 2:30 in the morning on the 28th of August. And they say that the fireball reached a peak apparent magnitude of negative 16, which is about 20 times brighter than the full moon. Now, they've got videos of that, and it blows your mind because it actually cast shadows on the ground. They said that the meteoroid was weighed more than 240 pounds at least, and it hit the top of Earth's atmosphere traveling at 56,000 miles per hour. Now, the reason I was aware of it is I heard the sonic boom, which was heard all over the southeast. And a lot of people in my area heard it and wondered what the dickens was that. They say that this was the brightest event observed in 5 years of operation at NASA. They said that these reports of sonic booms affected four Doppler radars and indicated that some of the meteorites fell along the ground track map in Cleveland, Tennessee. And they say an initial calculation of the fireball's orbit suggested it might be a fragment from a Jupiter family comet, but recently, and they're constantly working on it, it's got them all scratching their heads. It was a big boom, you guys. But they say improved estimates of the orbital parameters point to a different kind of object, a main belt asteroid. This is something they thought has come from now an asteroid belt. And they say if little meteorite pieces are recovered from the Tennessee countryside, they will analyze the chemical composition and learn more about the origin of the fireball. It just reverberated the house, and it did it twice. And I said at the time, I said, "What was that?" It's like one of those big sky sounds that I've been reporting about for, some months back since we've heard anything about that. But, you know, there was a theory about sky sounds as being connected to incoming meteors. So I don't know, but that's what it sounded like, and it was loud. So that was a big deal. Everybody's talking about that. So if you weren't in the southeast, you missed quite the show. And they have spotted a spy satellite. I wanted to tell you about that. Also on the 28th, they say that a Delta IV Heavy rocket, which they say is the world's largest rocket, blasted off from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and its secret payload was classified by the National Reconnaissance Office. So much for secrets, because everybody's onto it, because amateur sky watchers are already tracking the satellite as it circles the Earth. Now, nobody really outside of classified circles knows exactly what this satellite does, but speculations center on the possibility that it's a keyhole intelligence satellite, and keyhole satellites are a bit like the Hubble Space Telescope, except that they're pointed at the Earth instead of the heavens. And spaceweather.com is offering an app to turn your smartphone into a spy sat tracker. And they are saying, because since they're watching us, why not watch back? So they have an app for your smartphone that will tell you exactly where the spy satellite is at any given time. So anyway, that's a bit of information for you if you're interested. And also, there was a bunch of budget cuts from Congress, that sequester that we all heard about. Well, the U.S. Air Force space surveillance radar will be shut down at the end of September. And this is what has been used by spaceweather.com for their space weather radio. And people are wondering what this means for space weather radio, because they will no longer have access to these satellites, these radars. And so what they're doing now, they plan to still make it available. They are going to use new frequencies in order to read these activities in space. And so they're working with it now to see if they can use their alternative frequencies to track meteors, because now the government information is no longer available. That's for you space nuts out there that know about this kind of stuff. And there was a fireball seen from Texas and New Mexico on the 25th of August. In fact, they're just happening all over the place right now. There was a mysterious ball of fire that happened in Italy. Italians in the northeast are looking for traces of a fireball that raced across their sky in the early hours of last Tuesday morning, and unsettled pets. In fact, excuse me, it was not last Tuesday, it was this Tuesday, it was today. Now, this ball of fire was thought to be a meteorite, and it happened between 2:30 a.m. and 2:45 a.m., and it was accompanied by a loud bang and a thunder-like roar. That's kind of like what I heard, a loud bang and a thunder-like roar, except it shook the house. So there's just a lot of things going on in the sky with these fireballs. And they just discovered a new asteroid, which has just flown by the Earth, and this story came out of Moscow. They said an asteroid about 23 feet in diameter just passed by the Earth today, only a day after it was discovered. It was just discovered yesterday. And then they said the asteroid was first noticed by Arizona's Mount Lemmon Observatory, and then it was confirmed by astronomers in New Zealand and Bulgaria. And it flew by Earth at a distance of about 140,000 miles and came through about 10:30 in the morning. So anyway, lots of activity up there. And speaking of Italy, I mentioned that earlier about the Italian fireball. On August 24th, residents in Rome were alarmed and startled to discover that a steaming vent spitting out a steady stream of water and mud had erupted from the ground near a runway at a busy airport there in Rome. And geologists are wondering if it's a volcanic vent. They're looking to make sure it's not a broken pipe or some other accident, but you know, when you look at the video, it's clear it's not a pipe. Some experts are calling it a fumarole, a vent of steaming hot hydrothermal water that erupts at the Earth's surface. And so they say that there's a lot of hot springs in the area around Rome, and they think that maybe it's just a new vent, but volcanologists are looking at it, sampling the gases that are coming out of it, so they can have a better idea of what the ultimate source of this vent might be, whether it really is from a volcano or what the heck it is. And you've all probably heard of Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. This is the man who claimed that he handled debris from the 1947 crash of an alien spacecraft near Roswell, of course. We've all heard of him. But he passed away just the other day at the age of 76. And they say he was doing what he loved best at the time of his crossover. He was reading a book about UFOs. And he passed away at his home in Helena on Saturday, less than 2 months after making his last trip to Roswell. And as you probably know, over the last 35 or so years, Marcel Jr. appeared on TV shows. He was in documentaries. He was a guest on umpty-ump radio shows. He was interviewed for magazine articles and books. He just traveled around the world talking about his Roswell experiences. So Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. has crossed over in the last few days. And some interesting stories, some concerning stories about some animals along the planet. You know, I track this because it is connected to the Earth and what we call Earth changes and stresses on the planetary environment. This is a concerning story. More than 100 elk have been found dead in northeastern New Mexico. And that is a lot of elk, people. Elk are really big. And they all just dropped dead, apparently, within just minutes or a few hours of one another. State biologists are trying to just figure it out. It's a big mystery. But this whole herd just dropped over, and they were all on a ranch about 20 miles north of Las Vegas. And the elk weren't shot, so the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish is trying to figure out what caused these elk to die. Their top suspicion is that something called epizootic hemorrhagic disease was what affected the elk. It's something that is caused by insect bites, but nobody really knows. And also, on the coast of Guatemala, there has been a tragedy with sea turtles. Residents and visitors have observed over 80 sea turtles that have been washed up on the shore there, and this has been occurring since the first week of July. So where are we now? The first week of September, 2 months, and we've lost 80 sea turtles in Guatemala. And there's been earthquake activity, as far as I can tell, has been pretty quiet, but there was a good-sized one in Alaska. A magnitude 7.0 occurred east of Adak, Alaska, here on last Friday. And have any of you heard about that terrific snowstorm they're having in southern Peru? Have you heard about that? Has that been on the news?
No.
Well, I didn't know about it either. And this is dated yesterday, by the way, but they say that snowfall in parts of the southern highlands of Peru has killed more than, get this, 25,000 animals and destroyed 137 homes. And this is according to the Peruvian government. They declared a state of emergency in 250 localities across that countryside because they expect the snow to continue for about 60 days.
Oh, my God.
Now, yes, on Saturday, as of Saturday, there were a total of 5,247 people injured. And they said that this whole snowstorm situation has affected over 67,000 people. They say that 739 homes are now uninhabitable, 316 kilometers of roads have been damaged, and 252 hectares of crops have been injured. So that is a wild thing. That is a major, major snowstorm. So I wanted to pass that along to you because I just found out about that. And, you know, we all kind of moan and groan sometimes about exercise, but there was a really interesting article that I picked up about exercise. You know, we've been knowing for a long time, probably since the Kennedy era, when he instituted physical education in schools, that exercise is good for you, right?
Right.
Well, we all know that. We belong to gyms, and we work out, and we run and jog and bicycle and all that. But what researchers are now finding out is that on a cellular level, exercise affects the genes. They say that exercise drastically alters how genes operate. And studies show that genes are not static. Now, they either turn on or off depending on the biochemical signals they get from elsewhere in the body. So, when turned on, genes express various proteins that will in turn prompt a range of physiological actions in the body. But they say now that exercise affects the way genes operate because how that works is it involves a process called methylation. And this process, and I won't get into it, it's technical, but they say it makes it easier or harder for the gene to receive and respond to messages from the body. And they say that through methylation, the behavior of the gene is changed, but not the fundamental structure of the gene itself. And remarkably, this is amazing. They're saying that these methylation patterns that affect gene behavior can be passed on to offspring. And that's a phenomenon called epigenetics. So if you exercise, you're going to pass the good stuff on to your kids. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
I'm just amazed by that. They're just learning all kinds of stuff. Fascinating. And this end story for tonight is the most lovely story. My goodness, I wish you all could have seen this video. And maybe some of you did see this story because it was broadcast on the major news networks. But this is a story about a woman from Santa Barbara, California. Her name is Edith Kirchmeier. And they say she's used to helping other people who need some help. She has, since the 1970s, volunteered for her favorite charity called Direct Relief, because she writes thank you notes to supporters of this particular medical aid organization. And by the way, I have to say to you, she has beautiful handwriting. Well, you may wonder what that has to do with anything, but I'll tell you in a minute. She belongs to Facebook, and she took it upon herself to drum up awareness for the charity's cause by asking on her birthday, as a birthday gift, she asked for 150,000 likes of this Direct Relief organization on its Facebook page as a birthday wish. Well, what's so amazing about this woman is that she's 105 years old.
Oh, my.
And at 105 years old, she goes every day, or however often she goes, to this Direct Relief charity and writes thank you notes to the people who donate or contribute in some way. Her handwriting is absolutely amazing, as I said. This was shown on the video. But she used to drive to work in a 1997 minivan. And she still drives, by the way. Didn't I tell you that?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, an anonymous donor who appreciates everything that she's done gave her an incredible gift for her birthday this year, a brand new Honda, to replace that 1997 minivan, which was giving her difficulty in getting to work. And yes, at 105 years old, she still drives. And she says that she's never received a ticket or been in an accident. And she's been on all kinds of broadcast television, but I guess she was on the Ellen DeGeneres show. How do you say that? earlier this year. You know what I mean. Anyway, she said she just passed her driver's license test, and she was apparently the oldest driver in California. And this dear lady started out driving in a Model T 86 years ago. And she has more than 36,000 followers on Facebook. And she's the oldest member of Facebook. And people just love her. They call her an inspiration. Well, if you saw this video, you just wouldn't believe it. This is an angelic presence. This woman is beautiful. And she's very humble, too, which is really beautiful and lovely to see. She says that all this attention she's been getting is very surprising. She said, "It's overwhelming. I never thought I'd make that much of an impression on people." So there is a very humble, beautiful person at that age just making such an example for others. And, you know, I often hear people say, you know, we're a very youth-oriented culture, and many of us are afraid of getting old. And people really dread getting old. And I've often heard people say that they don't want to live to be too old, and people dread that. But this is a beautiful example of what can be, and a very good reason why we all need to live long lives and take care of ourselves and be healthy. Because in a healthy society and in a healthy world, longevity isn't as much of a problem as it is in our society today. And older people have so much to offer with their wisdom, their gifts, their inspiration. And so I say we should all live as long as we can and do as much good as we can. And this beautiful soul is showing us the way. She is really something, and her name is Edith Kirschmeyer. You can Google that and find out more about her. You didn't see that on any of the major TV networks about her?
I did not personally, no.
Well, you know, you have to watch a lot of TV to get all these stories right. And we don't watch that much TV. So, but wow, it's just so beautiful. But anyway, that's going to do the news for tonight. I'm looking forward to the show.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Anastasia. Wonderful stories, and I'll have
it's
to go
my pleasure.
Take a look at Edith Kirschmeyer.
You might type in Edith, 105-year-old driver, because otherwise her name is difficult to spell. It's K-I-R-C-H-M-A-I-E-R, and I think it was on CBS and some of the other networks. So that's how you have to find it. And look for her on Facebook. I'll bet you can find her there.
Well, great. Great.
All right.
Well, thank you
well,
so much.
Well, Anastasia Slavendar, I have a comment about Rome. You know, years ago I was told that at one point in time there would be an earthquake underneath the Vatican, and the vault would open and the papers would fly out. And so maybe this is the precursor for that.
Well,
coming.
Once again, you know, I come up with these news stories, and Lavendar, you're amazing. And I would say that, you know, all of these earth changes that we're seeing and things that are happening, I mean, the events are just enormous. There's so much news going on of great importance. Media doesn't cover it. You know, they want to keep us stupid. And this is an example. Here you got this information so long ago, and yeah, you really have to wonder. This is really, you know, a major thing. This isn't some little something. They try to pass it off as, well, maybe it's just a, you know, a little hot pot or something. But, yeah, this could be very significant with all the volcanic activity going on all over the planet right now. So, yes, I agree with you. I think we all need to keep our eyes and ears open because things are getting really interesting.
Yeah.
Even if you don't find that out by watching broadcast television.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Well, we have Nick Redfern on our switchboard waiting, and I'm going to bring your mic open here in just a second. Hello, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me back on again.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We had a lot of requests because everyone was just fascinated with all the stories and research on so many interesting and fascinating things. So we're glad to have you back.
Good. Well, thanks for having me back.
Lavendar, you want to kick it off?
Yes, I will. Oh, Nick, it's just such a pleasure having you on before. And, of course, we had our private conversation not too long ago about the Men in Black. And And I've been looking at some of the questions that we went over before from the other show, and there was a couple of them that I don't remember if I asked you about or not, and that was the Pentagon has an open file on Edgar Cayce and his information about Atlantis. I don't remember asking you anything about that. Do you have any information you could share with us about the Pentagon and Edgar Cayce?
Yeah, there's actually, this is one of these stories where it's really only just surfaced in the last couple of years, and so we're not really sure of the full extent of the story. But it basically relates to, apparently, official interest in work that was going on at Cayce's, the Edgar Cayce Foundation in Virginia Beach in the early 1960s. And unfortunately, beyond that, that's all we really know. All we know for sure is that a number of agencies were taking an interest in Cayce's research for some reason in that particular time frame. And so it might be sort of an idea for people who are really into Cayce to sort of look at, you know, what was going on in the world of Edgar Cayce. I mean, I know he wasn't alive then, but certainly his foundation was doing a lot of work. So the interest may have been relative to something. Perhaps, you know, they were doing something new in the early 60s that prompted that interest, maybe.
So do you have any information about Atlantis, something that maybe we haven't talked about before, people that have gone in that area and found different things? Do you know any new information about anything that's happened in the Devil's Triangle area?
And unfortunately, I don't. I mean, I won't say it's sort of gone quiet. I mean, there are people who are actively sort of researching under the oceans all the time, because there are often, you know, people find evidence of what look kind of like enigmatic rock structures that seem to be more man-made than natural formations. But I'm not personally aware of any new developments in that area, no.
Okay. Well, I remember that we talked a little bit about your book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon. So I'd like to just kind of talk about that for a little bit.
Sure.
Legendary Robert Oppenheimer, the brains behind the atomic bomb, have secret knowledge of a localized nuclear war fought in India, possibly tens of thousands of years ago. I had not heard about this. Can you enlighten us?
Yeah, sure. This is a sort of very weird story. And as I said, it relates to none other than Robert Oppenheimer, who was the brains behind the atomic bomb. And what's interesting is that Oppenheimer had an obsessive interest, and it's probably accurate to call it an obsession, with an ancient Indian text called the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata tells of a battle thousands of years ago in northern India between two opposing tribes. And there are indications that the Mahabharata itself is actually based on an even older document or text or manuscript, if you like, that may go back tens and tens of thousands of years. Now, you would imagine even a few thousand years ago, if, you know, a manuscript described like a battle and a conflict between two opposing forces in India 2,000-3,000 years ago, you would imagine them, you know, on horseback with shields and swords and, you know, bows and arrows and spears, etc., for that time frame. But when you read the translated version of the Mahabharata, it actually sounds eerily and almost like chillingly like an ancient nuclear war. Now, of course, we didn't develop atomic energy, certainly in a weaponized form, until the 1940s, you know, when it ended the Second World War with the bombs dropped on Japan. But the theory is, as it relates to the Mahabharata, that perhaps tens of thousands of years ago, there may have been a culture, not exactly like ours, but perhaps, you know, in certain parts of the world, they were far more highly advanced and wiped themselves out or became extinct for whatever reason. And when you read the Mahabharata, it doesn't talk about these opposing armies, you know, fighting on horseback, etc. It actually talks about them taking to the skies in aerial vehicles known as Vimanas. And they were described as being incredibly fast-moving, and, you know, there would be this sort of huge plume of light would come out of the back of them as they would take to the skies. And they would launch these sort of iron cylinders, as they're described, at the enemy cities. And it talks about how when these iron cylinders would hit the cities, there would be this gigantic plume of smoke in the sky, which would, you know, go miles into the sky and hang there ominously for days or weeks. And there was a great flash associated with the explosion as well. And even more interesting, in the days and weeks that followed, the people who survived the initial attack started to die under mysterious circumstances, where their hair fell out and their fingernails fell out, which kind of sounds like the lingering effect of radiation poisoning. You know, people thinking you survived the blast, well, I'm going to be okay, not realizing, you know, you've been breathing in or your body's been absorbing deadly radiation for 2 or 3 days. And when you read it, it really does come across like somebody's talking about an ancient atomic war. And of course, if there was something like this, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30,000 years ago, it really rewrite the history books in terms of how far back civilization goes and how possibly there's been this sort of cyclic situation of, you know, civilizations rising and then falling. And as I said, the most intriguing thing of all, as the story is in the book, is that Robert Oppenheimer was obsessed by the Mahabharata. And he was at a conference in 1952 talking about atomic energy, and he was actually asked, you know, when was the first atomic bomb explosion? And he said, well, in 1945, and then he added, in the modern era, as if to say, but not necessarily, you know, it wasn't the first one necessarily, it was the first one in the modern era. And he actually sort of emphasized that. So it kind of suggests that maybe he personally, because he was so obsessed with this book, that he personally had some suspicions or possibly even secret knowledge, given, you know, the classified work he did in government. He may actually have had some knowledge or suspicions that, you know, we weren't the first to develop atomic technology, and that the story had been repeated in the Mahabharata. But obviously today most people view it as like as folklore. But if you read it from the perspective of an atomic war, it actually sounds just like it.
You know, some time ago, I can't remember when this actually happened, but I got a hold of some information that talked about Sodom and Gomorrah.
Mm.
And I just feel like that after I researched that information and thought about it for some time, it made sense that some kind of nuclear device happened to level Sodom and Gomorrah and left the Dead Sea dead. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can find a lot of stories like that, like the Mahabharata, like Sodom and Gomorrah, where something just been sort of pummeled and destroyed out of the blue. Kind of similar to like the walls of Jericho coming down, which were supposedly to, you know, the caused by trumpets being played. But, you know, that is obviously like a folkloric interpretation, but the number of military agencies around the world are now heavily researching what is called acoustic weaponry, which is where you can have directed high-intensity acoustic waves, which can actually sort of lift objects and knock down objects, essentially. It's kind of similar to, you know, if you put your finger on a wine glass and spin it around, you know, you can actually shatter the glass when it resonates at a certain sound, sort of like that. So I think a lot of these ancient stories, like Sodom and Gomorrah, the Mahabharata, the walls of Jericho coming down, I think it's evidence of some sort of ancient technology, but clearly some of the stories, I think, were sort of not written up until maybe several generations later, and so they became distorted and kind of take on like an air of mythology, if you like, or magical folklore, but still having some sort of basis in reality, even if the people who wrote the text weren't necessarily fully, you know, conversant with atomic energy, you know, when the story of Sodom and Gomorrah was written, but they may well have inherited it, you know, from previous generations who did know.
Yes, yeah, I agree. So let's talk a little bit about what the Pentagon has done researching the pyramids of Egypt and trying to decide whether it was levitation or anti-gravity, or was it just slaves? What did you find out about their research?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about not just the pyramids in Egypt, but also the similar or slightly similar pyramids in South America and Mexico and Stonehenge in the UK. The creation of all these huge structures and these massive stones, they all have one thing in common, regardless of the location and the time frame. But all the, of the cultures that were responsible for them have legends about the stones not being moved by sort of ropes, pulleys and things like that, but they were supposedly magically lifted into the sky. And what's interesting is that in the same way with the walls of Jericho supposedly being brought down by sound, you know, the stories from the Sound of Trumpets, all of these cultures have stories about the stones being lifted by sound as well. And again, this comes back to this phenomenon, if you like, called acoustic levitation, which is now being more and more studied and developed by various agencies. And basically what it is, you have sort of what are called opposing acoustic signals, which create a what's called a resonance zone between the two. And you can a lot of research has been done, and small objects have now been successfully lifted in this resonance zone and held there, not by physical means, but by opposing sound waves. And if you read all these stories, for example, from Stonehenge, the story is that the stones were put into place, and they were sort of danced into place by magical music that was conducted by Merlin the magician. And if you look in South America, they have stories about small goblin-type creatures that could move the stones by playing a flute. And there are similar stories from Egypt about how music, and also Tibet, how Tibetan music that the lamas secretly knew, had ancient knowledge of, that they could lift stones to the tunes of a musical instrument. So, in other words, while we shouldn't interpret, you know, it literally that you can move a stone with a flute, you know, any more than you can magically dance it to the tune of music, I think these are all distorted versions of this sort of advanced technology in the hands of the ancients thousands of years ago. And we've lost our knowledge of that technology today. That's why we don't really understand how they built all these massive structures. And what I found, getting to your question, is that the Pentagon was very interested in the research of a number of key authors and writers who had actually addressed this very issue of acoustic levitation and anti-gravity. And one of them was a man named Maurice Jessop, who in the 1950s wrote a number of books on UFOs, one called The Case for the UFO, which studied not just UFOs, but Jessop's own research when he traveled to both Mexico and South America and personally investigated a lot of the huge structures there and came back fully convinced that something like levitation or anti-gravity was the only answer to it that was possible. And what I found intriguing was that a number of official files, which I got through the Freedom of Information Act, had actually been opened on Jessop's research way back in the 50s. So clearly, as far back as then, there were people in the official world that were studying it even sort of half a century ago. And there was another researcher named Bruce Cathy, who wrote a number of books in the 70s and 80s on, again, this issue of ancient levitation in the past. And there's also an official file on him. So clearly, even if they don't have all the answers, somebody was definitely taking an interest in this, you know, as I said, going back 40, 50 years and possibly even more.
You know, I met Bruce Cathy with George Van Tassel at,
cool.
at Giant Rock. What a fascinating man. And,
he's got some very interesting ideas, yeah.
I got a couple of his books. I don't even know if his books are still available.
They are. I mean, his classic one is called Harmonic 33, which is like the first one where he really lays out, you know, this scenario of how these energy grids and can move stones and, you know, and for all intents and purposes, make them practically weightless. And he believes that the UFO phenomenon today possibly utilizes these same energy grids, so to speak, that allowed the stones to be moved. And, I mean, when you look at some of these stones, you know, people say with the stones of Egypt, for example, I mean, some of these, they weigh multi-tons. And a lot of people don't realize that not only is it the issue of raising the stones, but we know from studying the stones themselves that they were actually quarried 500 miles from where the pyramids stand today. So, in other words, all these stones, all these blocks that weigh multi-tons, weren't just, you know, in the area, you know, sort of quarter of a mile from where the pyramids were built. They first had to be transported 500 miles, which, you know, across the deserts of Egypt is not the easiest thing to do. You know, it's okay if you've got a 5-lane highway and a bunch of trucks to load everything on, but, you know, we're not talking about that at all. You know, it's you imagine moving all these stones for 500 miles, then you've got to build them as well, you know, to extraordinary heights, and it all becomes a little bit too unbelievable when people just say, oh, it was done with pulleys and ropes, which doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything at all.
What have you discovered about the Ark of the Covenant? Have you been given any information about what that actually was?
Well, I mean, apparently, I mean, I've not dug into this personally, but I do know people who have looked into the Ark of the Covenant and have uncovered stories about the CIA having an interest in it, and at some point, at least in the 1960s. And what I think is interesting about the Ark of the Covenant is, again, if you read the descriptions of it and what it could do, it sounds like it was some sort of high-energy device or high-energy weapon in some respects, because there are actually sort of warnings in the original texts about warning people not to get too close to the Ark of the Covenant unless they were wearing certain clothes. Now, that kind of almost sounds like, you know, people who work around various electrical devices, you know, you have to wear rubber soles on your shoes to, you know, in the event that you receive electric shock, you know, the current, you're basically grounded, you know, so you won't get an electric shock. And it kind of sounds like that, but, you know, when people have got to wear specific items of clothing before they can touch it, that does sound like it had the ability to sort of generate an electrical field. And, you know, there are stories about it supposedly being a way to communicate with God. Well, you know, that could also be something in from our perspective, like a two-way radio, you know, a walkie-talkie, a cell phone. You know, it's the interpretation, I think, based upon the words of the people of that era, perhaps not understanding the technology or even really understanding what technology is, you know, and putting another slant on it, that it was a way to speak to the voice of God. It may have been, you know, the equivalent of a cell phone. But, you know, what it actually was, that's the big question. It was described as this sort of intriguing-looking chest that, you know, four or five people had to carry. It wasn't a huge thing, you know, it was just like almost like a dresser type thing. And, you know, what happened to it, that's the big question. There are all sorts of stories about it being stored here and hidden there, and nobody really knows. But I think when you peel away the stories and the rumors and everything else, I think it was some sort of highly advanced machine that had, you know, potentially had fatal capabilities, possibly due to, you know, as I said, powerful electrical currents. The big question is, you know, is it something that was built by an ancient terrestrial civilization, or was it something constructed by an extraterrestrial situation? You know, we just don't know.
You know, I had a funny picture just in my mind just now of them carrying it around, and when they get to where they're going, they open it up, and there's a cell phone that says Verizon.
Well, yeah, maybe they time travel back from the past and, you know, took them a cell phone. Who knows?
Oh, okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what else you have found out that the government's involved in and what they're really interested in now. Where's their focus? Is it Mars? Is it you know, these anti-gravity energy devices? Where do you think they're going with their research?
Well, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that a lot of research is being done in military agencies into things like anti-gravity and, you know, new and novel technologies and power sources for a couple of key reasons, the main one being that, you know, the natural resources of the planet aren't going to last forever. And, you know, we know that. And, you know, we're using them up at an extraordinary rate, and we're using the planet up at an extraordinary rate as well. So something somewhere has to change. And it's not so much just the reliance on oil that's the problem. It's the fact that oil is power, you know, and So it's a case of bleeding it all dry till it's gone, because it allows, you know, the power system to be maintained. And I think that's the problem. I'm fully certain, based on, you know, the research of a lot of people, that there are far more cleaner ways of powering your car, you know, factories, everything, than just kicking out massive amounts of smoke and, you know, just reliant on oil. But when that becomes, you know, an issue of money and economies and things like that, that kind of overrules things. And it's almost like, you know, it's like somebody says, oh, I'd never get sick. You know, it's not going to happen to me, like a heart attack or something. It's kind of like that, where they're just turning a blind eye to, oh, well, it's 50 years from now. We're not going to be around. Who cares? You know, I think that's the approach that's taken. It's kind of like bleeding everything dry for now and not worrying about, you know, the next generation after the next generation. And so I think there's no doubt, well, I know there's no doubt that advanced propulsion systems and fuels are being researched. The thing is, to what extent they'll end up in the public domain, and that's the problem. They should be in the public domain, you know, and it would make for a better world if they were.
What was your reaction the other day when on the news they decided to say, yeah, Area 51's real? What was your what was your hit when you heard that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the thing is, everybody knows, whether you're interested in UFOs and whatever, everybody knows Area 51 exists. It's, I mean, it wasn't so much that there was a denial of the base beforehand. It was more just, well, they just wouldn't talk about it, you know. And so, on the one hand, it's kind of a bit, well, it's not anticlimactic, but it's more, I guess, that because everybody knew about it, the fact that it was admitted to exist wasn't sort of like a mind-blowing thing. But what I would say is that, you know, that the admission was that it exists, but there was no admission made that, you know, there are anything like UFOs or dead alien bodies stored there. It was just, okay, you know, there's an installation where we do research and things like that. And Area 51, it's actually part of the what's called the Nevada Test and Training Range, which is this huge area of desert in Nevada. And various parts of it over the years have been used for different things. That's why it's called Area 51, because there are other areas, you know, which have number designations as well. And it's where a lot of the research was done into the stealth bomber and also the early spy planes like the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. They were all developed on the test and training range. And as I said, Area 51 is just one part of it.
So have you ever been to Area 51?
No, I haven't. I mean, you can actually drive to about 15 or 16 miles of the installation, but you cannot get any further because, you know, there are security guards, private security companies that police the place. So it's not like you can go up to the fence and look at it. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
no, I drove up there years ago.
Yeah,
years
you just
ago.
Cannot get close. And of course, you know, it's one of these situations where, when you're not able to get there, of course, then a lot of rumors start developing as to what's really going on. But, you know, certainly there's no doubt that over the years, strange-looking aircraft have been developed. And again, the question is, are we flying somebody else's weird-looking aircraft, or are they all ours, or is it a combination of the two, you know?
Yeah. Okay, I want to now go to the book that you wrote, Monster Files. Mm-hmm. Which we talked about a little bit on the show the last time. There's a story in here about, it says, Owl Man attracts the men in black. He was on his journey at the England's Plymouth Airport. Can you tell us that story?
Excuse me. <yeah. coughs> Well, this involves a friend of mine named John Downs. And John runs a group called the Centre for Fortean Zoology out of the UK. And Fortean, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, is named after a man named Charles Fort, who roughly 100 years or so ago wrote a number of books on a whole wide range of unexplained phenomena. So in other words, Fortean means after Charles Fort. And the Centre for Fortean Zoology that John runs is a full-time group dedicated to the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, sea serpents, the Chupacabra, you know, the whole range. And one of John's passions, if you like, what to call it, it's not really an obsession, it's one case that really interests him, is the story of an English creature that's become known as Owlman. And you, as you might guess from the name, it's actually very similar to the so-called Mothman, more famous Mothman of the United States. And the Owlman is described as like a strange-looking humanoid creature with wings and these bright, glowing red eyes that are described as like fiery red coals. And it's rumored to haunt an area of woodland in the southwest of England called Morn and Woods. And over the years, a number of researchers have dug into this very, very deeply. And on one occasion, John spent time with a man named Doc Shields, who was the first person to actually uncover the story of the Owlman. This was back in 1976 when the story first surfaced. And John, over the years, spent a lot of time with Doc Shields and you know, trying to figure out what the truth was about these Owlman sightings. And 20 years after, on one occasion when John and Doc met up, they were actually vigorously questioned by a number of government officials from a department of the British police force called Special Branch, which is like an elite intelligence division of the British police. And they asked them all sorts of questions about, you know, where they were going, what they were doing. And it sort of really hit home to John that, you know, somebody was monitoring his activities. And the fact that Doc Shields was there at the same time, it all seemed to revolve around the Owlman. And we find that, as bizarre as it sounds, we find that a lot, where government agencies are not just interested in strange creatures, but they've opened files and, you know, watched a number of people who investigate these things as well.
And didn't he have something to do with the zoo too there?
Yes, there was another case actually that John investigated where the British police force had opened a file on a number of strange killings in 1978 at a place called New Quay Zoo, which again is in the southwest of England. And a number of wallabies, something had basically broken into the wallaby pen and killed them in very strange circumstances. And so a police investigation was launched because, you know, none of the other zoo animals are obviously responsible. And there was all sorts of talks about big cats killing the wallabies, and there actually are a lot of wild big cats allegedly roaming the UK. There are stories about people owning them decades ago and then couldn't look after them. You know, they secretly bought them as exotic pets and then let them loose, which, you know, there's probably some truth to that. So that might explain why these cats would be roaming around. And of course, you know, in the zoo itself is in a fairly wild area, so if there are genuine wildcats out there too, you know, they're going to soon pick up on the scent and the fact that, you know, there are caged wild animals and wildcats in the zoo. So, you know, it might not, as crazy as it sounds, it may not be beyond sort of the realms of possibility that these wild escape cats actually made their way, you know, into the zoo and then killed these wallabies. But it was clear that it wasn't done by wild dogs or anything like that at all. And John managed to get hold of the files on this. These police files, and he was able to confirm they were genuine, but he actually got them before they were officially declassified, and he was never able to find out how the researcher who gave them to him, how they got hold of them, you know. That so it's a very strange story, sort of tinged with bits of conspiracy as well.
I want to direct our attention to something called the Mermaids, Myth or Hoax. I'm really fascinated with this because there seems to be so much truth in the fact that a lot of people have actually seen mermaids down around the Yucatan area and some other areas. I've had some friends tell me that they had experiences with some. What's your hit on the mermaids?
Well, I mean, I include this chapter in the book because in last year, the Animal Planet put on a two-hour documentary about mermaids, and the thrust of the show was that there was an arm of the U.S. government, and it's a real arm of the government, but it basically said that this particular body had secret proof that mermaids existed and they were a potential hazard and a threat to the human race. And they were presented as not as like not like hot-looking Daryl Hannah in Splash or anything like that. They were more like the creature from the Black Lagoon, like a savage-looking, like a reptile-type person, that kind of thing. And the story that was presented in the show was that millions of years ago, an offshoot of the human race spent more and more time in the water, and eventually, you know, lungs became gills and fingers became webbed, and they turned into like a savage, gruesome race of fish people is probably the best way to describe it. And the story was that our legends of mermaids were sort of born out of sightings of these actually far more savage and monstrous looking humanoids that spent most of their time under the water. And a lot of people were sort of confused by this show. It was called Mermaids, The Body Found. And it actually turned out to be the Animal Planet's highest rating show since they did their sort of memorial show on the death of Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter. And a lot of people were confused by it because it was actually presented as if it was factual, but it was actually a spoof documentary, and no sort of notice was given to the fact that it was a spoof. But the official agency that is referred to in the show, it actually took on really conspiratorial overtones, because the real version of the agency, or the real agency, I should say, that was sort of fictionalized in the show, they actually put out a statement on their website saying, we don't have any evidence that mermaids exist. And some people said they were almost protesting too much, you know, as if in a strange way, the Animal Planet had actually hit on a real story about secret knowledge of mermaids that was, you know, they'd uncovered so much that, unbeknownst to them, that it actually sort of infringed on a real classified program concerning mermaids. So, you know, it was sort of a very strange situation. But it gets rerun now and again. And if you ever watch it, you will. It's really well done. And it looks like, you know, it's talking about the real agency and people from it. You know, there's people listed as like Dr. This and Scientist That. But they're all actors, but you would never know from watching it. That's why it's sort of such a curious show.
You know Jim Mars, don't you? You know Jim.
Yeah, Jim lives only about 30 minutes away from me.
Do you see him often?
I see him now and again. I haven't seen him for a while, actually, but we stay in touch, and you know, I run into him now and again at different places, like conferences, or you know, somebody might put on a little party or something, and he'll pop up. So.
We should have him on the show. Do you think you could make a phone call and see if he'd come be on our show?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Okay.
Jim's got loads he can talk. I mean, Jim's done everything from, you know, UFOs, and obviously he wrote a book on the Kennedy assassination, and, of course, you know, that comes up for its 50th anniversary in November. So, you know, he's done all sorts of different things. So.
Yeah, I know. I've often wanted to meet him. I've been, you know, tracking him for some time, so... I remembered seeing something in your book that you had interviewed him or you'd been around him, so we should probably have him on the show.
Well, yeah, Jim's a nice guy. I mean, you know, everybody thinks with conspiracy researchers they're all very serious and whatever, but Jim, you know, Jim's got a great sense of humor. He's a very, you know, funny guy. He's the life of the party, and, you know.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're at the top of the hour, and so we probably have some people that want to call in and ask some questions. So I'm going to turn it over now to Arielle. Back to you.
Okay. Well, we do have some callers with questions, so we can just get to that if that's okay with you, Nick.
Yeah, that's totally fine, Arielle.
Okay. So we are first going to be talking to Larry. Hello, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. My question was, I'm sure you've looked at the original photographs of the stillborn children that were buried with King Tut, and I noticed that they didn't fit in their coffins. They were shorter. It was like they were put in there real quick, and they just picked a couple coffins for them. And I also noticed that one of them appeared to have teeth, and I don't know too many stillborn children that have teeth. And I also noticed that one of them had big eyes and the skull features like what you might consider a gray alien. Is it possible that Tut died in a flying accident? First question.
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, to a degree, obviously, we're going to be sort of speculating, but I mean, you can actually look at a lot of these ancient carvings and drawings and, you know, pictures on stonework, not just in Egypt, but in South America as well. And the drawings of the people do look kind of odd. You know, there are some where they seem to have elongated and oversized heads. You know, as you said, the eyes seem oversized. There are reports where, I mean, other carvings which seem to show dwarfish-like creatures, but humanoid. So, you know, and of course, in Egyptian culture and folklore and in their religions, you know, you have like the dog-headed gods and goddesses, that kind of thing. So, you know, there's no doubt that if those drawings and, you know, carvings are literal, then a good argument can be made that, you know, there were some very strange-looking people around back then, if they were indeed people.
Okay. Now, I also noticed that King Ramses II had long red hair, and it's been reported that that was the actual color of his hair, red. Mm-hmm. Do you see a connection from there to the red-headed people of Ireland, the Scottish people, and the red-headed English people?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, you can sort of look into the accepted stories about, you know, Columbus discovering the United States and all this type of stuff, but then you can push it back further. For example, the stories about the Vikings supposedly traveling to the United States, you know, more than 1,000 years ago. And we're really just sort of guessing when we say, oh, well, this is the first time this place was visited or that place. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there'd been sort of, you know, crossovers between the Celts of, like, Ireland and Scotland and Wales. And, you know, who knows? They could have made it to mainland Europe, you know. And I mean, it's only 20 miles from the coast of England to France. And then you're on mainland Europe. You know, you can literally make your way to Africa and Egypt without actually leaving land. You know, it's not like you've got to cross an ocean once you're in Europe. So, in that sense, you know, there may well have been, I don't have any proof, I should stress that, but I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there'd been massive amounts of sort of, you know, encounters between different civilizations that we just don't know anything about. You know, history's just lost the stories or whatever.
Don't have the records. Okay. Well, yeah. Now, in 1965, I went in the museum in Carson City, Nevada, and downstairs was a 12-foot skeleton, a woman's skeleton, and she had long red hair. And the sign said, unknown Indian tribe. And I called there recently, and I got a hold of a man who was there when she was there, and he said the Smithsonian Institute has taken her and won't give her back.
Well, there's a lot of stories like that. I've investigated some from Death Valley in California from the 1930s, where supposedly in at least two locations in sort of deep underground chambers that were accidentally discovered, that there were supposedly giant bodies, or skeletons, I should say, that were like 9 or 10 feet tall, but humanoid and perfectly proportioned. You know, I mean, occasionally you'll find somebody today who grows to like 8 or 9 feet tall, but that's due to a medical condition called gigantism. And, you know, unfortunately, often they don't live very long and their limbs are malformed and they have a lot of problems walking around. That's because that's not their natural size. You know, we're not meant to grow to 8 to 9 feet tall. You know, it just causes so many bone problems and things like that. But these skeletons found under Death Valley in the 30s were supposedly perfectly formed, as if they, you know, that was their natural height and so forth. And there are actually a number of stories also linking the Smithsonian with some of these giant skeletons. And I mean, if you actually, you know, go into a search engine and type in giant skeletons plus Smithsonian, you'll find there are actually numerous accounts like this, and particularly many going back to the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. And you can find these stories all around the world as well. So, you know, I think it's like one of these situations where there's smoke, there's fire, and there may well have been, you know, giants at one point. Certainly most ancient religious texts, you know, talk about when there was giants in the earth, you know, and so again, for these stories to exist, I think there has to be a basis in truth somewhere.
Right. What's your take on the Las Lunas Decalogue stone inscription? There's a star inscription at the site there at Hidden Mountain in New Mexico, that if you bring the constellations back to that star inscription, it's got a solar eclipse. It dates it to 6800 BC. Do you believe that's the real deal there?
I've got to be honest, I don't really know anything about that at all.
Oh, Las Lunas Decalogue stone inscription, Phoenician and Paleo-Hebrew inscribed into the stones, and a star inscription at the site dates at 6800 BC.
Hmm. Oh, I'll look into that. I actually haven't heard of that one, so it's one I've overlooked.
What part of New Mexico?
Just outside of Las Lunas.
Okay.
If you just type in Las Lunas Decalogue stone inscription, it'll come up. And then you have to look on YouTube, other people that got photos and shows you the star inscription and how to bring the constellations back to date it.
Wow. We'll have to look into that.
Yeah, the top line on it, somebody has recently destroyed it, but reading from right to left in Phoenician Paleo-Hebrew, it says, I am Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh-Yah-Wah, have no other before me.
Wow.
It's got the Tetragrammaton written on it in ancient language.
Sounds like you're a little bit of a historian and anthropologist yourself, Larry.
Yeah, well, when I discovered the Tetragrammaton, I found that in the Native American names, long before any Columbus, they have it actually written into their names, and my great-grandmother's tribe was spelled Y-A-H-O-O, and then the English word skins translates to English so well because they signed their skins. And when they asked them, what's the name of your tribe? What do you call your people? They said, Yahwah, and signed their skins, the people standing in the coast of skins of Yahwah.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and the imagery on their fire circle just happens to be a six-pointed star with a circle around it goes on the ground.
Wow. Well, there's a new lead for you, Nick.
Yeah, it's something else I've got to look into now. So.
That's great. Well, Larry,
yeah.
Do you have any questions?
Well, you won't find that in the history books about the imagery on their fire circle, but if you ever make one, each line of the triangle is 12 feet long, and you point the first point of the first triangle directly where the sun comes up. And the point of the triangle just opposite of that when you lay it on the ground is the Earth's gate. And then you put the sacred circle around it, and that's where you enter in. That's the medicine wheel.
Wow. Very interesting. Well, thank you for bringing us this information.
Good, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, well, we have another caller with a question, and if you do have a question, you need to press 1 on your keypad so we know that you want to come on the air. Next, we are going to be talking to, as soon as I get the mic open, hey, Ralph, you're on the air.
Hi,
welcome.
How are you? Well, thank you very much. It's a very interesting program. And, Nick, I was just wondering if you were familiar with Robert Duncan, who was the author of the book The Matrix Deciphered?
No, I'm not. No, I don't know.
Okay. But anyway, his research, he worked for the CIA and the Echelon and NSA and so forth, and he was a programmer who actually helped develop this cyclotronic engineered system that could transfer someone's thought patterns to someone else, and vice versa. It could switch thoughts from someone else to create what they call a cyclotronic clone. Are you familiar with that kind of technology and what's going on with that right now?
No, I'm not. I don't know anything about that, unfortunately. No.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if that was in your sphere of knowledge or not, but I think some of the research you've done is very, very interesting. So, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
thanks,
Yeah, I guess it's one of those things where, you know, there's so much going on, and some researchers, you know, focus on one thing, somebody focuses on something else, which is good, you know, because that way we've got sort of experts in different fields, I guess. So.
Right, right. So, well, Nick, you have a book called The World's Weirdest Places. And would you pick a couple of stories from that book and tell us
some places you've come across? Yeah, well, the publisher of the book, New Page Books, they do like a series of books. They did The World's Most Haunted Places, The World's Creepiest Places, and they asked me if I wanted to do The World's Weirdest Places. And they basically give the author, you know, sort of free rein to choose whichever places you want, you know, But the criteria that makes a place weird is that what they wanted was places where there's like a wide range of strange things going on. You know, not just say there's like a famous haunted house in town, but if there's a haunted house plus there's been a famous UFO case and maybe Bigfoot was seen in the woods nearby, that kind of thing, where, you know, the area itself seems to be sort of saturated in strange things. So I picked sort of 25 of them that I'd sort of personally investigated and traveled to about 15 or 16 of them over the years. And, you know, there's some weird places. I mean, for example, I mentioned Death Valley in California about these giant skeletons. I actually have a chapter in the book on that and about how these giant skeletons were discovered in Death Valley in the 1930s, but Death Valley also has a more famous mystery to it. It's called The Mystery of the Sailing Stones. And if you Google Death Valley plus Sailing Stones, you'll see images and lots of articles and photographs of these large stones, which you can find all across Death Valley, that have trails behind them, as if they've sort of magically moved across the sand under their own weight. And some of them weigh in excess of like 120, 130 pounds. You know, they're big stones. And nobody can figure out what's moved them. Now, the one theory is that perhaps sudden falls of rain could create like a thin veneer of water, and then the desert winds could push them along, almost like a little boat, you know, that kind of thing. But that really takes some accepting, because, you know, for the initial wind to sort of kickstart a 130-pound block, you know, just on a thin amount of water and keep it going for like 300 yards or something, it's really not that feasible. So there's clearly a mystery there. And there have also been a lot of UFO sightings over Death Valley and occasional, even strange creatures, a couple of Bigfoot cases from there. So that's sort of like one particular classic example. And another one I focused on back in England, where I'm originally from, where I grew up, which is a little village in central England, only about 10 miles away, there's a large area of forest called the Cannock Chase. And the Cannock Chase is almost like a magnet for weird stuff, as forests often are. You know, they're sort of perceived as magical places. But there have been sightings of large black cats on the loose, kind of like the equivalent of a black leopard over here, or a mountain lion in terms of size, but completely black in color. And there shouldn't be anything, you know, there should not be any large wild cats roaming around the UK at all. But there are many reports from the Cannock Chase. There are UFO sightings, even reports of werewolf-type creatures roaming the woods, where people have talked about seeing what looks like large wolves, and then as they've approached them, the creature suddenly like reared up onto its hind legs as if it can walk on two legs and four. A lot of ghostly activity in some of the old mansions and, you know, places like that that are over on the Cannock Chase. So that's sort of like a second example. And as I said, I include 25 in the book, which cover everywhere from the US to the UK to Russia to Australia to India to Iceland, and, you know, just about here, there, and everywhere in between.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, what about, excuse me, on a personal level, strange things that have happened to you.
Mm. There's been a few of those.
Yeah. I was just looking on your website, and you talking about paranormal paralysis.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. you know, this is something I experienced once, and a lot of people experience it at least once in their lifetime, and some people get it a lot. And sleep paralysis is the simple term for a medical condition called hypnagogia. And it's basically when you go to sleep, and people often have a dream that doesn't really feel like a dream. It feels like they're awake or semi-awake, but still in kind of a dream-like state. And they have a sense of a threatening presence in the bedroom. And depending on circumstances, you know, some people see like a demon, or they see what's called the old hag, like an old lady. Other people see aliens or werewolves or whatever, but they're totally paralyzed and unable to move as this sort of creature or entity looms over them. And I had an experience of sleep paralysis in 2002 when I had like a classic situation of being in bed late at night and couldn't move, and had this sense of like a cloaked figure sort of ominously coming down the corridor between the living room and the bedroom, and it was had like a wolf-like head, but it was on two legs and had this long cloak and was making these sort of fast, almost growling noises that sounded like a language that I couldn't decipher, you know, and it was all very sort of ominous and threatening. And, you know, I made that effort and finally broke out of that paralysis, and then the thing was gone. And that's sort of typically how these situations play out. Now, you know, skeptics in the scientific community say it's just the brain misfiring at the period when you're perhaps fast between sleeping and waking. They said that's when most of these events occur, and they say it's triggered by the fact that you're not fully awake and you're not fully asleep. But the big question that doesn't answer is why everybody in that state should report threatening encounters with strange beings in the bedroom. You know, why shouldn't one be a friendly encounter? Or why shouldn't it just be, you know, something where people don't see an entity, a being, they just see something else? You know, why is it that it's always like a threatening thing, threatening to do bodily harm or suffocate the person or whatever? You know, it's like it follows exactly the same path, you know, no matter when or where the events occur. I mean, you can find stories of sleep paralysis actually going back thousands of years, like in ancient Babylonian texts where they talk about people having dreams of these demonic entities, you know, breaking into people's bedrooms while they slept and kind of invading their dreams. And it's clearly they're talking about what's going on today. So I don't personally buy the idea that it's just due to the misfirings of the brain, because people, as I said, would be seeing anything, it would be all at random, and there's no reason why it should all be based around threatening entities in the bedroom. It should be, why not dream about watching TV and a penguin walks in the room, you know, but nobody does. It's always like a threatening entity, and this has given rise to the idea that perhaps there are, you know, we know that there are positive energies and negative energies, and one of the theories is that some of these negative beings, which may be existing more like a spirit form than in a physical flesh and blood form, can actually and literally like invade our dreams. You know, it's like they literally get into our heads, not physically, you know, but in spirit form. They're able to invade our sleep state and manipulate the dreams. And the theory for why it's done is that they psychically feed on human energy. You know, they're almost like a psychic vampire, and they feed on negative energy provoked by fear. So they get us into a state of fear by provoking a nightmare of these, you know, these hostile creatures in the room, and then they bleed us dry of the energy that's created by the fear. And a lot of people who have these sleep paralysis experiences do talk afterwards of feeling drained and wiped out, you know, as if they literally had been drained of energy.
Hmm. Yeah, I have experienced that myself, but it was just at one brief time, and oddly enough, it was when I was starting to awaken spiritually, and I didn't have the creature. Mm-hmm. But waking up, and there was some fear because I felt like I was out of my body, but not out of my body. I couldn't move, and I was having to fight just to keep breathing and hope that it would pass. It's been a long time since that happened, but I have always felt that it was that this, these kind of things are extraterrestrial related,
mm-hmm.
and that paralysis is kind of a side effect, like, you know, when they're bringing you back or they're about to take you, and it's always a positive experience as far as that is concerned with me, but it's just a really strange feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certain parallels with abductions where people talk about, you know, the paralysis and unable to move when the abductions are taking place. The one thing I would say that puts all the other ones aside is that the abduction ones aside, pretty much all the others are extremely traumatic for the people involved. You know, there's, for the most part, in sleep paralysis cases, I'm personally not aware of hardly any where, you know, it has like a positive outcome or the person feels positive about the experience. You know, it's mm-hmm. highly traumatic when, you know, you're sort of paralyzed in bed and this screeching old lady jumps on top of the bed, you know, and you're unable to move. It's, you know, it's one of these situations where I think a lot of the fear comes from the fact that the person knows this thing's getting closer, and they're not able to do anything about it. You know, they're not able to move. And that, I think it's that more than anything else that is the thing that the person remembers, you know.
Right, yeah. Well, thankfully, I guess mine was a slightly different variety.
That's good. Well, the most commonly reported ones, which are terms that a lot of people may know, are the incubus and the succubus, which are like demonic male and female entities that would force men and women to have sex, and they would sort of break into or invade the dream state again in the middle of the night, like a very similar situation. So, and you know, the tales of the incubus and the succubus go back again thousands of years. So, as long as people have been, you know, recording history and what's been going on, these events have occurred. It's not like it's something suddenly new.
Right, right. It might go through different generations.
Names, terms and names and theories, but it's always been with us.
Well, what's coming up for you?
Well, I've got a few things on the horizon. I'll be speaking at a conference called the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis in October. This is a conference that was first put on last year. By a man named Scotty Roberts, and Scotty put on a great conference, and he had a lot of the people there from the History Channel's Ancient Aliens show who were speaking, and he's got a good lineup again this year, and I'll be speaking there again this year on UFOs and government files, and he's got a number of other good speakers. Marie Jones, I don't know if you know Marie, she's a good friend of mine. She's written a number of books all on synchronicities and 2012, you know, with the whole Mayan thing, and strange coincidences and psychic phenomena, and she's done a lot of good work. So Marie will be speaking there, and but if you Google Paradigm Symposium Minneapolis, you'll see the full lineup, and that's like a 3-day conference, which, if it's anything like last year's, which I'm sure it will be, it was a very good one. And I'm working on a couple of new books, a third one on the Men in Black. I get that many stories from people, but you know, it's amazing how many people have had experiences with the Men in Black. And so I'm working on a third book on that right now, which I hope to hand over to the publisher probably sort of mid to late October, and then they'll get it published pretty quickly after that. So, and you know, just a lot of researching and writing articles like the sleep paralysis one. You know, that's I sort of do those every couple of days for various different websites I write for, like Mysterious Universe.
Okay, had you talked to Lavendar about her experience with the Men in Black?
Oh yeah, she gave me a very kindly interview for the book, and I'm working that one into to a standalone chapter. What I'm doing, I've got like 30 or 40 reports from people that I've put together over the last year or so. And the book will be a bit different because whereas most of the books I've written, you know, it's in my words, well, in this particular case, all the people I've interviewed, it will be totally their words, uninterrupted. And what I'll do is sort of do a little introductory piece telling the reader who the person is, what their background is, and then afterwards I'll do like a little comment section where I analyse the accounts. But for the most part, it'll be the witnesses themselves talking in their very own uninterrupted words, which I think, you know, people perhaps like that because, you know, I won't have any input as far as the story's concerned. I'll just make a little sort of comment and observation thing at the end. So hopefully people kind of like that bit of a different approach, you know, where they can sort of really get into the mind of the witness.
Right, right. And then they'll start seeing patterns and similarities.
Yeah. There are a lot of patterns and similarities with the men in black about how they almost seem to materialize on the doorstep, you know, and then when they leave, they vanish. And when I say vanish, I mean literally. You know, they always, well, very often they look strange. They look sort of pale and pasty and anemic looking and skinny and, you know, kind of ominous looking with these starry, wild dog type eyes. And a lot of people who have seen the men in black that I've got in the book were actually involved in occult activities, not the UFO subject, but they were also visited by men in black type characters as well. So that's, you know, a lot of people think the MIB are only associated with UFOs, but they've turned up in cases where people have seen Bigfoot, where people have been involved in seances, and both those two groups of people have had sort of this weird, ominous late night knock on the door, and, you know, they've opened it and you've got these little 5'5" white faced guys, you know, dressed like they've just walked out of like a 1950s gangster movie, you know, with like a long trench coat and fedora hat, and sort of very strange and surreal when you get into the sort of the world of the men in black.
Wow.
Yeah, they're nothing like the movie Men in Black, you know, like Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones,
right,
where they're portrayed as like agents of a secret government group. They're not like that. They're almost, they kind of look like The Walking Dead, but in better clothes, you know. the best way to describe them, you know, they sometimes they actually stagger, you know, and they look like a corpse that's just, you know, a fresh corpse or perhaps a dug up corpse.
Gosh.
And kind of like ghouls. That's how the real men in black are described. And, you know, very pale and white and anemic. And, you know, they just don't seem like normal people. And this has given rise to a lot of theories. Some people think they are like a paranormal creature, you know, like an occult entity. Other people take the view that, you know, these weirder ones. I mean, I should stress, I think some category of MIB are from government agencies, you know, that are looking into UFO cases, and they become part of the story, and that's why it gets confusing. But most of them, you know, have these paranormal overtones, and, you know, some people take the view that they're literally demonic, you know, they're like a demonic apparition or something like that. Other people think they could be time travelers from the future, you know, when the human race is perhaps on an evolutionary decline, and that's why they look so ill, and they come back to our time to sort of take genetic materials to try and improve, you know, the people in the future. So you've got a lot of intriguing and sort of out of the box ideas, so to speak.
Have you heard of the work and the book by Dr. Frank Stranges, The Stranger at the Pentagon?
Oh yeah, it's an interesting book. Yeah, I've written about Stranges. I did a book called Contactees in 2009, and Stranges is an interesting story because, you know, his was one of the classic contactee cases of meeting this back in the 50s, this human-looking alien that he called himself or himself Valiant Thor, and supposedly was, you know, somebody who had a lot of influence even within government, and you know, sort of trying to help pave the way, if you like, for, you know, sort of a better world, so to speak, which is, you know, what a lot of the contactees of that era, like George Van Tassel, George Adamski, Orfeo Angelucci, and Truman Bethlehem, they all kind of spoke about this, the idea that they were human-like aliens that infiltrated us, but not infiltrated us in a sinister sense, but they were trying to secretly I guess, push us down certain pathways without us knowing, but that would be for our benefit in the end. And, you know, Frank Strangers was certainly, you know, one of these who sort of typified that entire movement in that period.
Well, he had kind of passed the torch to a man named Craig Campobasso, who was our guest a couple of weeks ago, and went into great detail about the personal experiences connected with this story and how Dr. Frank met Valiant Thor. And there was a Men in Black part of that story.
That I'm
pretty sure that they were the of the government issue.
Yeah.
But
well,
yeah.
Of course, well, where it gets complicated is because back in the 50s, you know, people in government did dress in like the black suits and fedora hats. You know, that was, and it, you didn't have to be in government. You know, the average guy dressed like that back then. So that's why it gets confusing, because you have the government people who dress like that because that's how people dressed, and you have the MIB who seem to almost be copying that mode of dress to sort of blend in, and, you know, it acts as good camouflage, I guess. But what's weird is that they still dress like that today, even though our fashions, you know, you'd probably look twice if you saw a guy walking down the street in a black suit, black tie, and a fedora hat. You know, everybody would probably look at him twice. But the, in other words, the camouflage, if that's what it was, would certainly have worked in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But today, they still dress like that, but they stand out because nobody else dresses like that. So it's almost like they don't understand the common sense aspect of, you know, of what they're doing. And a lot of people say that the MIB don't seem to fully understand our customs and our ways, etc. And they, you know, that they threaten people and, you know, intimidate them. But if you stand up to them, it's like you suddenly rewire them and they become confused and they don't know what to do and they quickly make their excuses and leave. You know, it's almost like the threat is a bluff in some respects. And if you stand up to that bluff, it's like you kind of put a glitch in the program or something like that.
You know, it's almost now that there is an air of mystery and ominous feeling if you see someone that's dressed like that. And it's almost as if they want that to work in their favor. And certainly, of all the different varieties there are, it seems like intimidation is one of their agenda. And what could be more intimidating when now, after, you know, after Hollywood got done with it, the Men in Black are just easy to spot, like you said, because
people
don't see that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you actually made a very good point then about intimidation, because most people who see the weirder Men in Black, you know, they get this sort of creepy feeling from the person, not really knowing why. You know, I think we've all experienced that where you meet someone and you don't know anything about them, you never met them before, but you get kind of a weird, unsettling vibe from them, but you're not able to put your finger on exactly why that is.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody says that with the Men in Black. You know, that there's something that is just disturbing about them, and from their appearance, their mannerisms, and they kind of ooze this sort of sense of menace, or creates like a sense of menace in the person. And I think it is done deliberately. And again, this kind of ties in with the sleep paralysis angle, because some researchers believe that these entities or creatures, whatever you want to call these MIB, that they are like a psychic vampire, that they create high states of anxiety and fear, which they then sort of bleed dry from the body or the essence or the soul of the person. And again, like with sleep paralysis cases, there are people who have had MIB visits, and several of them have said, you know, they kind of felt like you probably imagine a diabetic would feel if they'd missed, you know, something, they missed two meals and they started to crash. That's how the witnesses often feel, as if they're being drained of energy and they feel lightheaded and faint, and they, you know, they get the shakes. And then when the MIB go, over, you know, the next few hours, their energy builds up again. But it's almost like they deliberately instill the fear as a ruse to literally almost like feed on it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, even in the animal kingdom, the one who is is fearful is the weak one.
Yeah.
And so if you wanted to dominate someone, if you could get them to be scared, then you could do whatever you want. And so I guess the key is to find something to laugh about. I'm thinking now of a Star Trek episode, original Star Trek, where there was an entity that fed on fear. I don't know if you remember the episode.
No, I don't.
But, it would terrify, and it would usually go after women because they were easier to terrify. And the way they overcame the situation was by giving everybody a shot of some kind of, laughing gas. And they just started laughing, and the creature lost all power and interest in them, and it went away.
So,
once again, what we need to know, we can find on Star Trek.
Well, what's interesting is, this whole issue of, bleeding us dry like a vampire, instead of living on blood, they're draining us of energy. What's interesting is that there are actually other vampire parallels. For example, when people get the knock on the door from the Men in Black, contrary to what a lot of people might think, because they threaten us, they'd imagine them forcing their way into the house. But the Men in Black never enter the house unless they're invited, which is like a classic aspect of vampire lore. Now, some of the people feel they're like almost hypnotized and impelled to let them in against, their normal common sense. If you've got a knock on the door at midnight, as often happens in these cases, and there are three creepy little guys, 5'5" tall in fedoras, you probably wouldn't let them in. I certainly wouldn't. But people do, and it's like something's taken control of their common sense factors. If they've been hypnotized in some fashion, and they invite the MIB in, and that's when they enter. So maybe some of these ancient stories about vampires dressed in black cloaks, demanding to be invited into the home, they may actually not have been literal vampires. They may have been distorted stories of centuries-old men in black,
Wow, that's an interesting theory. But there are, I'm sure, energies and entities that feed on various kinds of energy. Mm. And I would think that the best thing to do is to stand straight and tall and know who you are and know that nothing can have power over you that you don't give to it.
Well, actually, that's a very good point, because, as I said, people who've stood up to the Men in Black, it's almost like part of their threat is a ruse, because they just don't know how to deal with it when people do confront them. And they kind of, people reported them getting shaky and, as if they're going to fall sick, and they quickly make their, apologies or whatever, and they just leave. So that's kind of strange in itself. But what is intriguing as well, when you talk about, energies and the sort of the mindset of the person, a lot of people who've sort of delved into the darker aspects of the occult, and negative issues and things like that, they've attracted the Men in Black. And sometimes they're people who, it's clear from speaking to them, they're sort of weak-willed, and they were attracted to the darker side because they thought it would give them strength and, power. But it actually had the opposite effect, where these negative entities were able to get their claws into that person to a greater degree, purely because the person did have like a lower self-esteem or self-worth issues, and they found themselves manipulated to the point where then they couldn't get rid of these entities out of their lives. They sort of were disrupting things left, right, and center, causing bad luck and ill health and all sorts of things, until they finally just backed away from it all.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at the switchboard here. We have in a minute, we're going to have another person with a question.
Alrighty.
So, is there anything else that you would like to mention about your upcoming work while we're waiting for this caller?
As I said, I'm working on the Men in Black book, but I'm also working on another cryptozoology book. Cryptozoology is my other big interest, which is the study of the unknown animals like the Yeti, the Chupacabra, and so on. And there's a case that's always fascinated me. It's become known as the Oklahoma octopus, which kind of sounds strange. But I live in Dallas, Texas, and if I go sort of just straight up north to a little town called Norman, which is just over in the border of Oklahoma. There's a story of a large octopus or octopus-type creatures inhabiting a number of lakes in Oklahoma. Now, octopuses live in salt water. All these lakes are freshwater, so you know there shouldn't be such a thing as a freshwater crocodile. Nevertheless, there are a lot of reports of people seeing in these lakes these large tentacled creatures, anywhere from sort of 10 to 20 feet from overall length of the body and the tentacles combined. And they sound octopus-like, but there are a number of paranormal aspects to some of the stories, and the creatures have been seen in the same location. For example, there have been UFO sightings actually over some of the lakes. So you've got things like this. So I'm working on a book which is sort of basically like a road trip style diary of me traveling around the various lakes and interviewing the locals and, you know, people, veterinarians and police officers and, you know, the local media, anybody and everyone who's had some sort of input, and, you know, trying to do like a road trip diary style investigation of these Oklahoma octopuses or whatever they are. So that's what I'm working on now as well.
Wow. That's like the last place you'd expect to hear something like that.
Yeah, if you Google Oklahoma octopus, you'll find a lot of stories. And I say a lot of stories. There aren't too many detailed things on the internet. But I always find when you go to these places and you're sort of respectful to the people who live there and you point out, you know, you're just interested in the story, that's when a lot of the stories come tumbling out, you know, where the people in the little villages and the little towns know the stories, but they don't really tell anybody else unless you get their, you know, that you gain their trust, so to speak. And that's what I've done, is to sort of spend time, I like to spend time, you know, speaking to the witnesses and, you know, treat them respectfully and say, you know, if you're willing to share the story, this is going to sort of help increase our knowledge, etc. And you know, and just bring the material out. And but you have to sort of go out there and look for it. Otherwise, you know, it's just sort of regurgitated snippets of things on the internet, which really isn't that accurate, you know, very often.
Right. Well, we have our caller ready here with a comment about the MIB. Hello, Roger. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to clear some things up. You were talking about before being afraid of these beings. And the thing is, a lot of time when you step into some of these beings physically in their presence, they have energy fields too, and they're vibrating at a much higher rate. And if you're down much lower, when you step into their energy fields, it'll throw your energy field off. And a lot of times, people can't take it, and they black out. And that's one of the reasons we have such a problem with disclosure with some of these high-energy beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that would make sense. I mean, that might explain possibly, you know, some of these cases where people have felt lightheaded and dizzy, as I said, and, you know, they're going into like a, you know, like a low sugar mode in a diabetic. I know a couple of people described the situation. So, you know, maybe what you just said then is kind of like a tie-in with that.
Yeah, and I like to say, too, a lot of people report bad experiences with the grays, but they look into their eyes and they say they have a bad experience, but all these beings are doing is reflecting back to you part of yourself that maybe you should change or look at, and these people don't like to see this stuff, so they attribute the bad experience to them when all it is, it's really, you see what I'm saying?
No, I totally understand, and I actually agree with a lot of that. It's kind of like, you know, it's where people who think negatively attract, you know, negative energy. You know, somebody who sees every day is going to go wrong, well, things do go wrong, and if you have a positive outlook, I think it actually helps positively from your mind perspective, but also on the body. You know, sort of studies have been undertaken, you know, people who live in a world of negativity often are more susceptible to colds and infections and things like that, you know, and I think there's a great deal to that your outlook on life, the way your mind works actually has a, you know, an effect on us physically to a large degree.
But what these beings do is they get you to look at yourself to clear certain blocks so you can raise your consciousness. And a lot of people don't want to do this because they have a lot of dark secrets and they don't want to deal with those things.
Yeah.
And that's what comes up, saying.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of people perhaps feel, you know, sort of uplifting yourself and, you know, elevating you to a new level. I think sometimes people are almost frightened, you know, the fact that they enjoy, to a degree, being in sort of the safe four walls, you know, and things not changing. And I think often for people, change, it's the fear, it's not the change itself, it's the fear of the change, you know, that kind of worries and intimidates people. And it's kind of like when you first, I know, learn to swim or ride a bike, you know, afterwards you're like, well, what was all the worry about, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, people don't like looking at the skeletons in their closet, you know, so.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling, Roger. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was some interesting things you've got to say there. I think there's a lot to that about, you know, positive energies will attract themselves to positive people. Negative energies or negative entities are very cunning, I think, and get their grips into people, and, you know, they're easy to manipulate, and, you know, it comes off worse for the person in the end, unfortunately.
Right. Well, to make another analogy to the animal kingdom, you know, when the lion or the tiger is hunting, they go into the herd and they'll go for the weak one.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Why would you want to try to tangle with the strong leader when
that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that makes complete sense. So all the more reason to stand in your own light and take your own power. So, well, we have a few minutes left. If there's anything else you would like to add about your activities or your upcoming adventures?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see. What have I done? Or what am I going to do? I actually did a Chupacabra investigation just recently, which was an interesting one. Here in Texas, we get a lot of reports of what become known as the Texas Chupacabra. They're very different to the Puerto Rican ones, which is described as like a two-legged, hairless, monkey-like creature with these bat-like wings and a row of spikes down its neck. The Texas ones are like a hairless dog. And it's given rise to the theory that they're just coyotes with a bad case of mange, but they're not, because a number of bodies of these creatures have been recovered and autopsied, and they're not showing the telltale marks of mange, which are like intense scratching and biting and licking of the skin, because mange causes such irritation in the animal. It's caused by a mite, and it's kind of like the best analogy for a human is like when you get chicken pox, you know, you're going crazy, you don't scratch yourself, a scarring, but you know, you just have that intense itching, and that's what mange is like. But animals don't know any different, they just scratch themselves. But these Texas Chupacabra, their skin is perfectly smooth, but it's just hairless. And DNA analysis has been done on them, and they definitely have coyote DNA, but it's like the species or pockets of the species are mutating, where they're developing naturally in a hairless fashion, and their front limbs seem to be shorter than their back limbs, so they have this weird hopping-like movement. You know, the legs should be equal, so they walk, you know, in a natural plane, but they have this hopping movement. And their top jaw is growing longer than it should. You know, it should meet with the bottom jaw, but it's actually like a huge overbite of like 1.5 inches in some cases. And they don't show any fear of people, and they act in very sort of menacing fashion. So this is not an unknown animal, because they clearly have coyote DNA, but there's something about them that is mutating, it seems, at a genetic level, and we're just not sure why. And and I've been now, and as I said, on this expedition, I've been on a number of expeditions now, actually in Oklahoma as well, and in Texas, looking into some of these cases, and they're certainly growing. So there's something in the coyote population that has led to the birth of this thing that's known as the Texas Chupacabra, which is kind of like actually an inaccurate term, but it is, there's absolutely no doubt there's a real mystery. The mystery is why these animals are mutating. That's what we don't understand. And there are theories that, you know, everything from genetic secret experiments to pollution to just a weird sudden genetic anomaly that may have just surfaced for reasons we don't understand, you know, that that maybe sort of nature occasionally kind of reboots the program, so to speak, you know, and it injects some new like gene or something like that into the species, and it begins to alter.
Well, it certainly sounds like genetic manipulation, whether it's by,
yeah,
by, you know, a natural anomaly or by design. And they're just,
yeah,
in
we
Texas?
Just don't know, unfortunately. Yeah.
Are they just in Texas?
No, there's actually, ironically enough, the town of Norman that I mentioned, which is in relation to the Oklahoma octopus story, I went there in 2010 to the same town, Norman, to do a TV shoot with Fox News, because there'd been one up there, and a local boy had taken a photograph of one of these creatures near the school that he went to, and I took it on his cell phone, and on the photograph you can see it has these sort of ridiculously short front limbs that give it like this really weird kangaroo-like appearance. So they're definitely spreading. The ones in Texas, you know, everybody thinks of Texas, and certainly I did before I moved here, that it's all desert and cactus and cotton fields. It's actually not. You know, West Texas is a lot of cotton fields, but Central Texas and East Texas is heavily, massively forested, and most of the Texas Chupacabra reports have been around the large wooded areas around Austin and San Antonio. But when you go east of Dallas, you know, I can drive sort of an hour outside of Dallas, and you're in thick, heavy forest, which goes right through to the borders of Alabama and Louisiana. And when you go north towards Oklahoma, you know, you're getting into, again, rural and countryside areas. And this is where also these creatures have been seen. So they clearly are favoring areas where there's plenty of cover, plenty of forest land, which, of course, means small animals, you know, to live on. And so that makes a lot of sense. But the fact that we have these reports from more and more geographical locations suggests, you know, they're breeding quite successfully and spreading as well.
Wow. Almost have an image of some dinosaur kind of reptile thing, because they have the, you know, short little front legs
actually, that's not a bad analogy. If you Google Texas Chupacabra on images, you'll see some of the ones that have either been shot or run over by cars. And they look like something like a cross between a giant rat and a kangaroo, but with a skin texture and color of an elephant, like a gray-blue sort of coarse skin with these long ratty tails, and they look really, really weird.
Wow. And as far as you know, do they keep to themselves?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Most coyotes around people, you know, they'll shy away. These things don't. They sort of stand their ground. And people sometimes, you know, felt intimidated by them because they haven't run away. They've just sort of stood there staring as if they were actually sizing the person up, you know, to see if they could take them on, so to speak, in a fight. And so they don't have this innate fear of people, which a lot of, or shyness, you know, that coyotes normally do. So their minds seem to be slightly altered from the typical pattern also. Which again, we just don't know why. But in terms of the attacks on farm animals, what's weird is that they've been reported as having attacked farm animals and biting them on the neck to kill them, but they don't eat the bodies, they don't eat the corpses. And this has given rise to theories that, you know, well, is it possible they're drinking the blood? And that's why they've been called the Texas Chupacabra, because the Puerto Rican Chupacabra was supposed to drink or suck the blood of the animals of Puerto Rico. Now, there's only really one animal on the planet which can actually ingest blood, and that's the bat. You know, the typical example, the vampire bat, which does. You know, they take the blood very often from cows, from cattle. You know, they'll land on their hide and just stick their teeth in and suck blood out. But their internal organs are unique in the sense that they're designed to intake blood and actually use it as nourishment. You know, there's no mammal, as far as we know, that can do that, you know, other than bats. We couldn't do it. We couldn't live on blood. But people have suggested that maybe these Texas Chupacabra, that, you know, they seem to have a liking for blood, not necessarily in the sense that they can live on it, but, you know, they have more of a taste for it than the average animal would. You know, the average animal would just go for the meat. They seem to almost enjoy lapping up the blood, you know, which is very strange.
That's gruesome. Are they pack animals?
Well, for the most, we've had some reports of adults together, two or three, and there are some reports of people seeing one or two adults with a couple of pups, and the juvenile ones, they're completely hairless as well. So, you know, again, it's not just something where it's a condition that's developing after, say, 2 years, you know, the hair starts to drop out. It looks like they're being born like that as well to the parents that already have that condition. So, you know, we're starting to see patterns developing and we're getting more data, but we just don't know why it's happening. That's the issue.
Right, right. Well, that would be a departure from the coyote, you know, wolf pack mentality. You know, seeing one or two,
yes,
a little, you know, family is different from being part of the pack.
Yeah, they do seem more isolated. There is actually one famous case from Texas where a farmer and his son actually chased after one of these creatures that was on their property. They had this huge ranch, and they were in a Jeep. And I forget if it was the father or the son, but they got the Jeep up to like 40 miles an hour, and this thing was still outpacing them, you know. And that's kind of like the equivalent of like a cheetah, which is the fastest animal on the planet. You know, that can reach extraordinary speeds briefly, you know, sort of 55 mile an hour. You imagine riding, you know, driving down the highway at 50 or 60, you know, and a cheetah passes you because that's sort of the speed they can briefly make. But this thing was sort of outpacing this Jeep at 40 miles an hour for, you know, a considerable amount of time. So they seem to be, you know, this is the thing to remember with animals with mange. They get sickly very quickly because when they scratch themselves, the itching and the scratches get infected quickly and they fall sick. You know, an animal is not going to be outpacing a Jeep if it's hairless through mange. You know, it's clear these are healthy, full of vitality creatures, you know.
Yeah, they would have to be.
Yeah.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes here, so I want to thank you so much for joining us again. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Lavendar, do you have any closing comments?
Yes, I'm just so grateful that you came on the show, and I'm real anxious to see the book that you're doing on Men in Black. So stay in touch with me, and if you have a chance, see if you can find Jim Mars to come on our show. We would love to have you.
I'll make a note of that while I'm just right now.
Okay, good.
Right,
thank you.
Right now. Okay. Well, thanks again for having me on the show. I had a good time. Thank you.
It was our pleasure, Nick. Thank you so much. Once again, the website is nickredfern.com, and you can also find his books at warwickassociates.com. So thank you so much, Nick, and we are going to sign off. Thanks for listening from all of us here at Starseed Radio Academy, and we'll be back next week. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.